something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And it's Saturday. We're going into the vault for a classic episode from September 13th, 2016. What was this episode about, Robert?
Oh, well, this one was titled Scalp Hunters and the Cobra Effect. And it basically dealt with the unintended consequences of putting value on certain things. What we're referencing with the title, of course, is what happens if you say, all right, we want to deal with the cobra problem, so we're going to put a price on bringing in cobras.
Right.
Or in the one of the more horrific stories of American colonialism, putting a price on the scalps of native people. But then what happens when you do that? What kind of how does that shift the quota of violence? What do people start doing then to cheat the system?
Yeah.
And in both of these cases, you see people doing things to cheat the system.
Well, it's sort of – in this episode, we explore the nature of incentives.
Yes.
And what incentives do to – address problems people think they're trying to address and then to create other problems people don't predict.
Yeah, I can't remember if I discussed this example in the episode, but it reminds me of when we were trying to potty train our child and we
Did I give this
explanation?
Yeah, we save it for the episode.
Okay, all right. But I'll just say it involves pee-pee nuts and poop candy and everyone can enjoy the either enjoy it a second time or you can enjoy it for the first time.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
In this episode, we're gonna be talking about some darker content towards the end, as the title of the episode implies. And indeed, even the less dark elements we're going to talk about are kind of a crash course in the misadventures of colonialism. But before we get into all of that, we thought we'd kick off with maybe some lighter content.
Yeah, Robert, I understand that you want to tell me about pee-pee nuts.
Yes, I would love to tell you about not only pee-pee nuts, Joe, but poop candy as well.
Poop candy, that's what the dog believes comes out of the cat's butt.
Ugh. Now you've taken into darker territory, Joe. No, I'm not. I'm talking about the rearing of human children as opposed to dogs here. And this ties into the overall theme here, the use of often the use of bounties and bribes.
Yeah.
And then what happens when the economics of that spirals out of control? So my son is 4 now, but there was a time not too long ago when we were trying to potty train him to get him to actually urinate and defecate in the toilet when he needed to go, to listen to his body and follow up.
So it's apparently not enough just to say that is where you go do such business and point to the toilet. You actually – you need to introduce some incentives to motivate this behavior.
Right. And there are – there are as many different schools of parenting as there are parents. So some people have a real problem with using bribes in any situation.
Uh-huh.
But hey, it's what we did and it worked for us.
Then you've also got the poop anywhere parents who I hear are real trouble.
Well, that's I know people who are using that technique and that seems to work for them. But
I was just kidding. Wait, that's a real parenting philosophy?
I thought you were
poop anywhere.
Well, there are different toilet training techniques that imply it's not so much a poop anywhere. What it means is like the kid will go around without pants on,
mm-hmm.
and then when they need to go, you scoop them up, that sort of thing. So that's what I thought you were referring to there. Believe me, there are a lot of different techniques out there, and that one in particular, I know some people have used that and it worked for them.
Huh. Okay.
In our case, though, we issued a strict bounty for every successful urination in the potty. He would get one honey sesame nut from this little bag.
Honey sesame nut.
Yeah, like you buy at Trader Joe's.
Oh, I haven't had that.
Oh, they're delicious. I had to stop eating them for a while when they became pee-pee nuts for me, kind of by association, but they're great. And on the other hand, for every successful poop in the toilet, which was even more important to us at the time, he would get a single fruit gummy.
Okay.
And that was the poop candy. So the policy proved effective for us, but it also led to a period during which he began to make a case that each piece of feces was surely a separate poop and should then result in additional poop candies, as well as any interruption in the stream of urine would result in two or more instances of urination, and each would require a separate reward.
Okay, well, this is smart bargaining, actually.
Yeah, and it's crazy too when I look back and realize that he hadn't, and he still hasn't really discovered the power of lying. But there was still this tendency to bend the rule and even break the spirit of the rule for greater rewards. Now, after that, we clarified the policy, and then luckily we were able to phase it out shortly after that. But how might things have escalated if we hadn't? You know, that's something to think about, and I've been thinking about in researching this topic.
Well, Robert, I want to tell you a story. It might not be a true story, but it's an interesting story with some very true analogs about the power of incentives and the sometimes unintended consequences of incentives.
Okay.
And about serpents, of course.
Ah.
Asps, very dangerous. Now, the story goes something like this. In colonial India, you had a British colonial administrator who decided there were too many cobras in the city of Delhi. You know, I got cobras coming out of my ears. We got to get rid of all these things. Though I wonder what that actually looked like. I mean, if this really happened.
I imagine we're all picturing that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Yeah,
exactly. But it was probably more like I saw one cobra and that was too many. We've got a cobra problem in the city. But anyway, so he wanted to get rid of the cobras in the city. Kill them all. Get them out of here. So he came up with a solution. Put a bounty on the cobras.
Oh, okay. Sounds simple.
That makes sense. So if you kill a cobra, just bring the dead snake to the government office and receive a cash award.
Yeah, they are making it worth your while to take time out of your day to kill a snake or two.
Yeah, and at first it seemed like this was working great. They're collecting plenty of cobras. But before long, the local administrators discovered a problem. The people had figured out a way to game the system and turn the snake bounty into free money. They weren't catching cobras from the city and killing them. They were farming cobras at home, killing them once they were mature and then bringing them in to get the bounty. Now, obviously, they couldn't allow this kind of mischief to continue, so the administrators ended the cobra bounty. But now you had all these snake breeders who had been farming cobras in order to get the bounty, and they're stuck with hundreds of worthless snakes. So what do you do with them? Well, just release them. So they have no incentive for keeping them. They release them into the streets, and the cobra population in the city drastically increases. This leads to the principle that's now known to economists as the Cobra effect. And it's when a strategy implemented to solve a problem directly makes the problem worse. And the story about cobras in Delhi, as I mentioned, might be nothing more than a modern folktale. I haven't come across any evidence that it actually happened. But there are plenty of examples where exactly this type of thing has definitely occurred in the real world.
That's right. And one of them occurs with another colonial situation, another infestation in Hanoi, Vietnam. All right. This would have been the 19th century. So you had French colonial authorities in Vietnam. And, you know, there are various problems to focus in on, but the one they choose to really apply their attention to is the city's rat problem.
Now, I can imagine the rat problem was probably a real problem. Probably a real problem.
That, yes.
You know, like the cobra thing, you can imagine a colonial administrator sees one cobra and decides there's a cobra problem in the city.
Right. Yeah, because I can't think of a situation where another city has had a snake infestation problem offhand. But rats, of course, rat problems have been an issue throughout human history.
Yeah, it's quite common to have rat problems in any large population center. People produce a lot of garbage. Mm-hmm. Garbage is tasty. They have sewers that are great places to dwell in and have your little breeding grounds.
Yeah, they're smart and they're successful. And as was learned, this is the other key thing. This is one of the reasons that they focused in on rats so much is that in 1894, that's when Alexandre Yersin discovered that bubonic plague was caused by little fleas that rode on rats.
Oh.
So you can see why they were concerned.
Right.
So what did they do? Well, they did what often happens in these cases. They assigned some professional rat catchers to take care of everything. But then that's not enough. So they turned to volunteers. They turned to mercenary rat catchers. And they offer a bounty of 1 cent per rat tail. And the idea here was that, especially since disease was an issue, asking the rat catchers to handle the body was going to be too much to ask. It would be a burden and just a little gross.
Right. From what I've read, you know, they'd catch thousands of rats in the sewer in a very short period of time. Lugging all those dead rat bodies would actually be really heavy.
Yeah. And disgusting.
Yeah. So just to prove how many you killed, really just take the tail.
Right. So that's exactly what they did. They brought in the tail. And it seemed to be working at first. But then the authorities began to notice something curious in the streets. They noticed a bunch of rats running around without tails.
Ooh.
So they quickly realized that some of those enterprising rat catchers out there were simply lopping the tails off of the wild rats when they caught them, perhaps out of laziness, but more likely so that tailless rats could go forth, breed, and produce more rat tails to harvest.
Yeah, no, they were being economically smart. They were trying to, you know, if you are living off the land, you don't want to destroy all of the vegetation in the land. So you only pick from some of the plants. You don't kill every plant.
Right. It's like the policy that's supposed to be in place with stone crabs. You harvest one of the claws, mm-hmm. and then you let the creature go. You don't harvest them both.
Right.
So that was one of the ramifications of the bounty. But much like our cobra example, the exact same thing took place. Others took advantage of the law by establishing rat farms.
Whoops.
Yep. Because rats are easy to breed. I mean,
you don't even have to try.
You really don't have to try. You just collect some rats and let them do their thing, and you're going to have more rats, which you can then lop their tails off and collect your bounty. So the French were horrified that their efforts to curb the rat population was actually increasing it, and they scrapped the bounty program entirely. And in 1903, bubonic plague broke out in Hanoi. So,
oh no,
yeah. So there's a lot more. There are a number of more angles to this story. There's a great paper out there that ties all of this in with just sort of the doomed nature of French rule in Vietnam, and it's titled "Of Rats, Rice, and Race: The Great Hanoi Rat Massacre, An Episode in French Colonial History" by Michael G. Vann.
Yeah, and there's an older episode of Freakonomics Radio, actually, that deals exactly with the Cobra effect that I listened to. And it's a good episode. It's worth checking out. So we won't rehash everything they cover in their show, but just to mention a couple other interesting examples they bring up. One is a very similar situation to the rats in Hanoi, but this is with feral pigs in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Ah, so it's a local tale.
Right. Have you been to Fort Benning?
I've been through there, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. Did you see any pigs?
No. I saw an interesting overpass, and I believe that's the extent of it.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, it's in, I think, southwest Georgia. Is that right? Yeah. So there are a lot of wild pigs in this area. They're invasive, feral pigs, and they do a lot of damage. They dig everything up. They get into your garbage. They eat everything. They cause damage to government property and buildings. So people wanted to do something about this feral pig problem. So there was a cash bounty exchange program for pigtails established to fight the feral pig problem. But same problems we've encountered before. There's a lot of suspicion that some of these pigtails people were turning in for a cash reward came from illicit sources, maybe some meat processing. We're not exactly sure. And then in the end, it looks like baiting practices established by the pig bounty hunters actually probably increased the number of wild pigs in the area.
Oh, wow.
So people claim all these cash rewards because they put out a bunch of food to attract pigs and then they shoot some of them. But, you know, you were feeding the pigs, fattening them up for breeding and producing more pigs.
Because you're trying to put a value on the elimination of the animal. But in doing so, you've put a value on the continued life of the animal.
Exactly.
So yeah. It's interesting how that plays out.
And this brings me to a thought about the nature of incentives, because it sort of highlights that you can't have an incentive that's just sort of logically associated with the outcome you want. Mm-hmm. In order to try to prevent the gaming of the system, you really need to make incentives as closely aligned to the actual desired outcome as possible. So what I mean by that is, if you want to eliminate cobras from the city, don't offer cash rewards for dead cobras, because you don't want dead cobras. That's not the outcome you're looking for. You want an absence of cobras.
Yeah.
But that's a lot harder to incentivize, right?
Yeah, you'd have to have somebody come along and investigate for cobra free spaces.
Exactly. Yeah, you need more complex systems to try to incentivize that. So, for example, maybe you could establish a cobra control authority, and then the employees of this organization are given a cash bonus that's proportional to how few cobra bites are reported in local hospitals in a given year. But even with that, you run into some problems, right? Like, without strict controls on that, what if you have members of the Cobra Control Authority intimidating people not to report their cobra bites or not to go to the hospital, or intimidating people at hospitals not to report them to the government? So it just seems like whenever you introduce incentive programs to a wide-ranging, you know, group of participants, to the public essentially, you introduce the problem that people are going to find ways to access the reward without helping you achieve your goal.
It seems like it should be a Dr. Seuss book, or kind of a Sorcerer's Apprentice kind of tale, right?
Yeah.
Just as it spirals out of control in these examples. I can't help but think of quotas that are set forth for law enforcement sometimes, you know, like you got to get so many speeding tickets out there.
Uh-huh.
And so you end up having a police officer setting up in speed traps to hit those quotas.
Yeah.
Which in that case, I guess it's not a clear scenario.
It's not necessarily making the problem worse, but it's also just kind of like we're not really stopping it. We're just kind of like setting up a system to continually collect the bounty on speeding.
Yeah. Like, I guess I can see where there's a balance there. Right. So if it depends on like how high the quota is and how aggressive you are in carrying it out.
Right.
Because if there's a balance to where, all right, you're just people know not to go above a certain speed, or they should know. And if they don't, they get a ticket. So like both, and that is going to make the roads safer. But I guess the more the focus is on hitting the quota, getting essentially the bounty, and losing sight of the purpose of the law entirely, that's where things get out of whack and you end up with like notorious speed traps.
Right. And I think this gets into a concept that's very closely related to the Cobra effect, though I think technically the Cobra effect wouldn't have to be just in incentives and economics. If you're talking more generally about anything where an attempt to solve a problem makes the problem worse, you could even go to the example of like Ecce Homo, you know, that great story of the person who is trying to touch up this classic painting of Christ in his passion moment. It had some damage to it over the years, trying to touch it up, and he ends up having this kind of wailing monkey face.
Yes.
which is one of my favorite images from the whole internet.
Yes, but and she wasn't working for a bounty. But imagine if there was a bounty out there on restoring old works of art.
Right.
You could end up with however many of these strange little monkey faces just completely obliterating art history.
Yeah, I guess the problem there is that you are giving people who don't have proper training in an area an incentive to participate in the area, and thus they're probably going to make things worse.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question. Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But another way of framing the issue is just the concept of perverse incentives, meaning specifically in the Cobra effect, the intended solution to a problem makes that problem worse. Perverse incentives can just mean incentives that cause unintended negative outcomes, especially if they're contrary to the benefit of the people who offer the incentives.
This all also reminds me of a moment in one of my favorite books. Cormac McCarthy's Sutri.
Oh, yeah. We talked about this the other day where there's a bounty on, I think, rabies bats in that book, isn't there?
Yeah, like the local university there, they want to – or is it the health department? I can't remember. It's been a while since I've read
either.
It. But interested official parties would like to see the bodies of local bats.
Uh-huh.
I think it's because of rabies.
There's a very enterprising young character in the book named Harrogate, mm-hmm. who at the beginning of the book is arrested for having illicit relations with watermelons that did not belong to him. But then later on, he comes up with some just ingenious schemes for collecting bats. I think far more bats than was really than he was intended to collect.
Yeah, he ends up strolling into town with just a sack of dead bats, which he gets by, I believe, he buys some poison and he poisons little pieces of meat and slingshots them into the air because the bats are accustomed to preying on insects that are flying through the air. I believe that's the scheme.
That's a great book.
It is. It's just it makes me want to read it again. But at any rate, they end up kind of the doctor, the scientist ends up confronting him when he brings this bag in and says, "Look, we know you did not just find these bats, but we can't figure out how you did it. You've got to tell us how you actually killed these bats." And then he relates the story of the slingshot.
Oh, yeah. That's it. He was supposed to be collecting dead bats, but instead he was killing bats.
He was making dead bats. So, you know, in a sense, they were I guess the effort here was to protect humans, protect health, but also, you know, not eradicate bats. That was not the intended outcome. But Harrogate did his best to do just that in order to get the sweet bounty.
Mm-hmm. But of course, that is not the only book by our great brutal novelist, Cormac McCarthy, to feature bounties.
That's right. There's also Blood Meridian, a great novel, horrific novel. In large ways, I think unfilmable novel.
Yeah,
and I kind of hope it's unfilmable.
It is. Would you call it nihilistic?
Yes,
it is. There's just not much redeemable in the world, and it is a book of brutal and cruel people doing brutal and cruel things.
Yeah, and one individual who might not be a person at all, who might be an embodiment of awfulness.
The judge.
Yeah,
yeah.
Judge Holden, who himself is probably based very loosely on a real individual who was in a gang of scalp hunters led by an actual historic individual, one John Galton, who was indeed a superstar in the vile trade of scalp hunting, harvesting by some accounts 250 scalps in a single raid once. And fittingly, his group was eventually ambushed and scalped by a band of Quechan tribespeople. So.
So we shouldn't dwell too much on the nasty details, but we do need to discuss what scalping is and scalp hunting, what this practice consists of and where it came from.
Yeah. So, I mean, most of you probably don't even need to be told, especially if you've consumed much in the way of American Western history or fiction. Not only Blood Meridian, but Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove novels instantly come to mind as well.
Both. I've actually never read Lonesome Dove.
Oh, it's quite good.
Yeah.
And Comanche Moon is another one in that series that I read that was really good and really bizarre in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But both of these authors really gaze deep into the gruesome spectacle of the act. It entails the slicing, flaying, ripping away of a portion or all of the human scalp. And then you have this resulting trophy. The victim can be living or dead, and there are plenty of tales of scalping survivors, including in 1864, probably the most famous is a 13-year-old Robert McGee, and he's famous because there's a wonderful, gruesome photograph of him as an adult showing off his scalping scars. So, and in this case, he was scalped by a band of Sioux Indians. So look up that photo online if you really want to see it. But where did the act come from? That's actually something that has been there's been a kind of a debate on that over the years.
Right, because we definitely do see it practiced by both sides in the American frontier.
Right, yeah. So it comes down to, is this an ancient Native American act that various cultural groups took part in, or is this something that Westerners introduced, mm-hmm. That the colonists introduced to the New World? Now, certainly scalping was long attributed as a purely Native American act, and indeed we see plenty of examples of scalping both between tribes and against colonial invaders.
Yeah, and that's something I think even when I was a kid, just my idea of where this came from, I guess if you watch old cartoons or something mm-hmm. like that, you get the idea that this is something that Native American tribes, that their warriors would do to the enemies, not something that was done by European settlers, but in fact it was done by European settlers.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll see plenty of examples of that to come here. But I think it is often presented as this kind of savage thing that savage tribes people do.
Right. This Eurocentric view of it.
Yeah. Now, there was certainly a backlash against that view. As pointed out in a wonderful article titled The Unkindest Cut or Who Invented Scalping by James Axtell and William C. Struvant in 1980. And if you want a blow-by-bloody-blow account of the history of scalping, that's a good article to seek out. But they say that the quote-unquote savage Indian take on scalping was replaced during the 20th century for a spell there by Native American activists who really pushed forward the view that that it was basically bloodthirsty colonials who introduced the practice to the native peoples of the Americas by encouraging them to do so, by instituting bounties on other tribes people and essentially teaching them to take these head skins from others.
So under this revisionist view, the scalping practice came from the European settlers and was transferred to the frontier tribes.
Correct.
At the time.
However, after this, a lot of people on the other side of the issue, they weighed in. And really, when you do look at the history and look at the historical accounts, you see that the practice of taking scalps goes back way through colonial invasion to pre-Columbian times, okay? And it was quite widespread through North America and even parts of South America. There's archaeological evidence that shows evidence of post-mortem scalpings and skulls that showed evidence that the victim survived the mutilation long enough for the bone tissue to regenerate.
Wow.
And another point that's often brought up is that certainly Europeans had plenty of ways to torment and torture and mutilate the body.
Right. We're not trying to make them look good by comparison.
Right. But for all their drawing and quartering and hanging and hacking and what have you, you really don't see much in the way of scalp taking in European tradition prior to this point. And even language itself. Scalping as a word, the word itself scalp predates the 17th century. It arises from a Scandinavian root and it was featured in a 1601 edition of Pliny the Elder's Natural History, though the explorers in the New World tended to be unversed in Latin classics, so they probably weren't exposed to it.
Right.
Now, instead, such trophies were described as head skins or hair scalps. They just talked about skinning and flaying. Until scalps and scalping became a popular term in 1676 during King Philip's War between Native American tribes and the English colonists and their Native American allies. And meanwhile, there's a fairly robust vocabulary for scalps in many of the native tongues. The Ojibwa language distinguishes between scalp and Sioux scalp, so there's a separate word for each, while Eastern Abenaki language has special terminology for enemy scalps that are already taken as trophies, for scalps that could be taken, and scalps from the living and the dead. Hmm. So it's kind of like those the old saying that Inuits have all these different words for snow because there's so much of it. You could make the argument that the scalping was enough of a practice that there were specific terms that were used in some of these cultures for specific types of scalps.
Yes, but of course, as we see with the European invaders of the American continents, they had all of their own barbaric and violent practices. And even though scalping doesn't traditionally appear to be strongly represented among them, they took to it quite rapidly.
Yeah, you could definitely say that. I mean, they were kind of like, well, the way we did it back home is we just tore a person into four pieces with horses. But hey, if you want to just take the scalp, we can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the crazy part, because it's one thing to look at these native tribes who had this in their culture and their tradition, and there may even be certain, you know, supernatural elements that are factored into it. Mm-hmm. But the colonists had none of that. You just had a bunch of, you know, in most cases, Protestants showing up in the New World and readily getting into the act.
Right. It's not a part of their traditional cultural war practice. It's more just sort of an adopted act of violence.
Right. And violence, of course, becomes a standard in relations between colonists and the native inhabitants of the Americas. Mm-hmm. Pretty much from inception, pretty much from that first outside context event when the two met. Violence just continues to be a part of their history. And that's where the scalping really begins to pick up. So it seems, based on most accounts, all right, it's a pre-existing thing that happens between tribe members in their tribal wars, often as a way to take a trophy and then travel a long distance back with it, mm-hmm. kind of getting back to the idea of taking the tail of a rat, right?
Right.
But then the Protestants, the colonials here, they begin to perpetuate the practice by putting a bounty, say 10 shillings worth of truck cloth, on native scalps that are taken by your native allies. So take the scalps from the enemy tribespeople, the people that we don't have alliances with, and we will pay you in some cloth. All right. But then in the midst of King Philip's War, which we mentioned earlier, which went from about 1675 to 78, they extended the bounty to mercenaries, 30 shillings per scalp. And you end up with plenty of horrific cases. There's this case of a Puritan kidnappee, Hannah Dustin. She and her fellow kidnappees, they were held by a band of tribespeople, and then they escaped. And they went on to execute two men, two women, and six children. And they received 50 pounds as a reward for that act. And there's actually a statue of this woman in Boscawen, New Hampshire.
Is it just a statue of a murderer?
Yeah. I mean, because that's it really kind of sums up the weird ways we have historically made sense of this violence between these two people.
Well, yeah. I mean, talk about perverse incentives. So you've got a rat bounty system where mm-hmm. you assume, well, there's a rat problem, so we need to do something about it. So let's just collect rat tails, and that'll let us know there's at least some significant amount of rat killing going on. This seems like exactly the same principle being applied to human beings.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the thing. We see this bounty system spiral ever more out of control. The French engaged in it. The English engaged in it. And it eventually becomes not only this thing that you're asking other tribespeople to do, like, hey, you guys take scalps, right? Take the scalps of our enemies and we'll pay you. Scalps become become a valuable item for colonial individuals as well, hunters and trappers, et cetera.
Yeah, it's just evidence that you are carrying out the genocide that we're encouraging.
Yeah. The first Massachusetts Act of 1694 encouraged a bounty for any Indian life, while a 1704 renewal of that act amended it so that you only got 100 pounds for adults, 10 pounds for children, 10 and older, and nothing for kids under 10, which sounds semi-decent at first until you realize that those children would be sold as slaves or transported out of the country.
Wow.
Now, as early as 1712, some folks were uneasy about that. And this is kind of a sobering thought to realize that not everybody was just completely on board with this.
Yeah, I would hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, this is straightforwardly encouraging a bounty for murder.
Right. I mean, though at the same point, you have to acknowledge that, like, this was a tough time to be alive. Like, there's a lot of fear going on in these communities and among these lawmakers. But even then, there were people who said, I'm not sure about this. Massachusetts Judge Samuel Sewall spoke in a session of the Massachusetts General Court, and he said he laid out that he really thought that this was – it was only okay. It should only be done if you're doing it to protect your family. And if it's becoming something that you're doing for commerce, then that's bad.
Wait, so it's okay to murder a Native American, collect their scalp, and turn it in for money – as long as the reason you did it wasn't the money so much that it was out of love for family.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the basic Protestant ethos, right? I'm kidding.
Yeah. There.
But I mean, obviously that's the horrible situation here is that you have, it becomes the practice and then people have to, people in positions of power and authority have to find ways to support it and rationalize it in their own mind.
Yeah, but these rationalizations seem to be coming in direct conflict with the economic incentives being offered. If that's the case, why are you still offering the bounty?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And then it gets ever more out of control there, especially when ministers are speaking about it and they're not condemning it. There's this wonderful quote here from Axtell and Struvent's piece that goes, "When ministers not only look the other way but shared in the profits from Indian deaths, the moral barometer of America dipped dangerously low. At the bottom, however, lay the American Revolution, in which Englishmen scalped Englishmen in the name of liberty. Scalping and other techniques of Indian warfare placed in the hands of a larger European population eventually sealed the Indian's fate in North America, but not before wreaking upon the white man a subtle form of moral vengeance."
Hmm.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, a daily podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Every weekday, we bring you conversations with the culture makers who inspire us.
Like our recent episode with Hollywood royalty Regina and Raina King. We talked about the creative power of women's relationships.
I feel like, thank God for women, like, especially when it comes to Black women. The way we lean on our mothers, our grandmothers, our sisters, our friends, we're just each other's pulse. I mean, it's molecular, you know?
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At this point, I think when we think about the Cobra effect in relation to scalping.
Yeah. Is this an example of the Cobra effect?
Right. Because on one hand, it's kind of doing exactly what the bounty is supposed to do.
Right.
It's bringing about genocidal violence against the native population.
Then again, I guess if you interpret the purpose of such a bounty on Indian scalps as to be, I don't know, to pacify the border, you know, to mm-hmm. make the frontier less bloody, you're obviously having a perverse incentive there. I mean, you're causing murderous havoc.
Right. And there are plenty of examples, too, where the scalp trade just intensifies the violence. And you end up with various native chiefs in some cases who are putting bounties then for their own people upon the white man, and so you have this kind of a war of extermination from both sides. There are examples in some of the like in the Mexican examples we'll get to in a second, where Galton and his gang specifically they would roll into an area and violence would just intensify because they're just stirring up all of this hatred.
Yeah.
So, of course, scalp hunting continued and falsified scalping also pops up as an inevitability. Here.
Wait, so maybe just like collecting pigtails from a meat processing plant and saying, yeah, I shot all these pigs. You might have people getting scalps or parts of scalps from illicit sources.
Sort of, yeah. There's a quote that I ran across in these materials from 19th century American historian Francis Parkman. And he said, the hunting of humans would constitute a profitable occupation if only the prey was not so shy and nimble. So, I mean,
does that mean?
Well, you can't just – with the rats, you could just raise them, right?
Yeah.
And rats are everywhere. People can prove a little harder to kill even if you're a ruthless gang of mercenaries roving about.
Okay.
And people are going to inevitably figure out, well, how can I get the most out of this kill? If you would, read this next quote for us. It comes from 20th century German ethnologist of European colonization, George Frederiki.
Okay. It says, this, along with the high profits of the fatal business, soon taught the shrewd tribespeople and their quick-learning students, the lawless backwoodsmen and hunters, the art of skillfully making two, three, or even more scalps from one scalp and selling them. People were not always very particular about where the scalp came from, because it was difficult or impossible to distinguish between a French scalp and an English one. Members of friendly tribes and even fellow countrymen fell victim to greed and the scalping knife. Not even the dead were spared.
Yeah, so you could – this is interesting. It goes even beyond what Federici was talking about here, because you could apparently take a single adult scalp, you could stretch it as you dried it out, and you could cut it into a dozen different things that you could pass off or try to pass off as scalps, which is quite – you can see the financial possibilities there.
This is one of those moments where it comes up every now and then. You just imagine aliens coming in and observing our behavior.
Yeah.
And they're seeing somebody take the skin off the top of another human's head and stretch it and cut it into a bunch of pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. And it became such a problem in Mexico, where you had the Mexican states there paying mercenaries to go around and hunt for scalps. They had to demand that scalps all include one or both ears or the crown. And they even set up regulatory committees. But the thing here is that – and I guess you kind of have to put yourself in their shoes or try to imagine the kind of individual who ends up taking the job as a scalp inspector. Your job is to inspect these grisly trophies of human murder and genocide and then reject it if it's the wrong type of scalp or if it's been falsified. Apparently, they were easily bought off and you could – so you just bribe them and then they'll accept a child scalp as an adult and therefore there's even more incentive to kill a bunch of children. And that's exactly the type of behavior you saw from individuals such as John Glanton.
I think we called him Galton. Yeah, we said Galton, but it was Glanton, the Glanton gang.
I think I had him confused with the Eagles song about the Daltons. very different view of the American West. But still, the scalp trade continued, and in many cases, it seemed to escalate. And so, like July 4th, 1863, in response to raids by Dakota in southern Minnesota, the state issued $25 bonus payments to scouts who brought back a scalp, $100 for non-soldiers, and this later hit $200. So needless to say, a lot of scalping ensued. And in between 1835 and the 1880s, Mexican authorities, as we already mentioned, they paid private armies to hunt Native Americans, specifically targeting Apaches and Comanches. And I always find the inclusion of Comanches and stuff like this to be interesting because the Comanches, in large part, were they were the people of the horse. And where did they get this horse technology, this biotechnology? They got it from the Spanish who introduced the horse into North America.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they encountered this outside context problem. They survived it and really became the notorious warring people of the horse because of our interference. But that's kind of a separate tangent. But Comanche history is very, very fascinating. But wherever these bounties persisted, you just saw genocidal violence persist, and it really, really continued until the balance was successfully tipped completely in favor of the colonials and then was replaced by new anti-native activities such as relocation programs and re-education centers.
Yeah.
So the horrible history did not stop there by any means.
So in one sense, this might not be an example of COBRA effect at all if you just, as we said, think of the ultimate goal of the scalp bounty as being, well, just we want to exterminate the people who live here so we can make room to occupy the land ourselves. It seems like that sort of worked.
Yeah. I mean, the unintended consequence, if there is one here, aside from having to deal with individuals who are falsifying scalps and getting more money than they should have, is just the backwash of bloodshed and the fact that we – just the idea that the colonists bloodied themselves, bloodied their souls, and really just created this stain of shame for all time.
Yeah, well, perhaps we should leave the realm of scalp hunting, human bounties, and genocide, and come back to the idea of backfiring incentives in general.
Yeah, let's end on a lighter note.
All right. Now, Robert, I want to talk about the idea of negative incentives. So we've seen the idea that positive incentives can backfire.
Right.
Sometimes they backfire in just ways that produce unintended negative consequences. Sometimes they backfire in a way that completely contradicts your intention setting out, makes the problem worse. But there are also negative incentives. Sometimes you want to take steps to prevent something from happening and discourage it. But what about when that makes the thing you're trying to discourage more likely to happen? Here's one model. What if a punishment for a discouraged behavior itself becomes desirable in some way, especially like a symbol of coolness?
Okay.
So I can think of one good potential example of this. And there's a New York Times article from 2007 I came across describing a problem within the Bangkok Police Department at the time. So department officials were, according to this article, trying to put a stop to misbehavior among the rank and file officers. Mm-hmm. So if you park in the wrong spot, if you show up for work late, if you get caught littering, et cetera, there's some bad behavior among the cops and they're trying to disincentivize it. And the disincentive they came up with to stop this behavior was a form of a badge of shame, like the red letter. You get to wear something that lets people know that you have behaved badly. Uh-huh. And what they chose was a tartan armband. Unfortunately, this policy seemed to backfire, and the officers ended up regarding the disciplinary armbands as collectible souvenirs to take home with them. So the badge of shame became a minor badge of honor. And in trying to work around this problem, their chief of the crime suppression division at the time came up with instead of tartan armbands, they used these Hello Kitty armbands, hoping this would be seen as sort of a humiliating affront to the officer's sense of power and masculinity. I'm not sure how well that worked out in the end. But anyway, this one very small example illustrates the principle that a poorly conceived disincentive can not only fail to provide discouragement of a target behavior, it could potentially even increase the behavior if the disincentive comes to be seen as having some kind of value. Now, maybe that could be some kind of monetary or material value, or maybe it could just be some kind of cred or social capital, like coolness.
Okay.
There's certainly a sense of countercultural coolness, right? You know, like if a certain kind of shaming can be taken with pride.
Yeah, like, oh, it's too extreme for TV, too hot for prime time.
Yeah.
Ooh, if it's too hot for prime time, I've got to see it. How hot could this be?
Right. But then, of course, there are also examples where you could maybe have a material advantage. For example, I think about supposed tax schemes that reward people for making failed business investments.
Oh yeah,
you know, supposedly, like you can if you finance a really bad movie that bombs or something, you can end up manipulating your taxes in such a way that you end up with more money because the thing you financed bombed.
Huh? It's kind of a producer's scenario, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if that's really the case in any country today, but I've at least heard accusations that that is how some very bad films of the past few decades got financing. Don't know whether it's true. But there's another version of this I want to talk about, and that is the case of censorship. I think censorship is a classic example of attempts to stop a problem causing the opposite of the intended effect. The problem is there is a message or a meme or an idea or, you know, anything that is spreading content that you don't want disseminated.
Mm-hmm.
And attempting to stop the dissemination of that content very, very often seems to have the opposite of the intended effect.
Yeah, it just makes you want to see it or hear it or read it. If the man's telling me not to consume it, I kind of want to consume it at least to see what the fuss is all about.
Exactly. So there is a I found a Mercury News article from way back in 2003 describing the event that inspired what's now known as the Streisand effect.
Ah.
I assume you've heard of this, Robert.
I had not, actually.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
I'm familiar with Barbara Streisand, but I wasn't familiar with the Streisand effect.
Well, that is indeed the title celebrity behind this effect. So here's how the story went. So there's an environmentalist photographer named Ken Adelman, not the same as the political operative.
Okay.
But he was operating a website that I think at the time was called CaliforniaCoastline.org. CaliforniaCoastline.org is still up. I checked. And the purpose of this was to photograph many, many miles of the California coast to have before and after pictures of coastal development projects to track sort of coastline erosion and other potentially destructive effects of building projects along the coast.
So it's almost kind of like a Google Maps scenario where they're just going to take a whole bunch of pictures to give an overall visual impression of something.
Yeah, and I think the reasoning was that – so if you have a project come in, build a bunch of stuff on the coast, you might think that they have been destructive to the coastal ecosystem, but you don't exactly know because you don't have a picture of what it looked like before they built.
Okay.
But now you've got before and after photos. But apparently in 2003, the actress Barbara Streisand discovered that the site featured a photograph of her oceanfront home in Malibu. And she felt this was an invasion of her privacy and filed a $10 million lawsuit to have the photograph and references to her removed from the site or taken down.
Mm-hmm.
And before her lawsuit, it appears that the photo of her home was not a big hit. It was accessed by only a handful of site visitors. But in the month after the suit was filed, according to this 2003 article, more than 420,000 people visited the California coastline site, presumably to see what all the fuss was about. Now, I don't know what their traffic was before that month. Mm-hmm. It was a, you know, coastal photographs project in 2003. I can guess that it was not anywhere near 420,000 visitors.
Yeah, probably not one of the hottest websites out there.
Right. So, yeah, that's one example. But are there any other examples of this Streisand effect where the attempt to shut down discussion or to hide evidence of something just draws more and more attention to it? I can definitely think of the example of boycotts, movie yes. boycotts. Mm-hmm. So let's say we've got a new awesome demonic possession movie coming out, and it's got tons of graphic sex and violence and blasphemy, just wall to wall.
Okay.
And you get a bunch of church groups who call for a boycott of the film. They go stand outside theaters to protest it. Does this end up hurting the film's ticket sales or discouraging filmmakers from making movies like this in the future? Well, it's almost impossible to say because you can't go back in time and compare the film's success under a boycott and protest with the success of the same film under normal conditions. Like, you can't run the experiment with a control. It happened in reality.
Right.
And there's no way to control the experiment, but it is widely speculated, and I'm quite sure I'd agree, that these kinds of responses more often have the opposite of the intended effect, generating more publicity for and interest in the movie.
Yeah, like I can definitely think of films that were considered video nasties in the UK that became underground hits and were the kind of things you'd go to kind of great lengths to get on video cassette back in the day. And you look at them today, now that kind of you can get anything, you can actually find these films that you heard about and had such notorious histories, and you watch them, and in many cases they're horrible. There's just nothing. They're not even that shocking.
Yeah.
But the mere fact that they were labeled as such, that they were banned, that they were prohibited, and made this video nasties list.
Yeah.
They end up surviving. They end up becoming far more famous than they had any right to be.
Yeah. The insistence that you must not look at a thing really increases your curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of people today who are seeking out and watching some really terrible, low-budget Italian horror films and finding themselves very disappointed because they don't match up to the reputation they had acquired over the years.
So here's the idea I have about how to turn the Streisand effect into money.
Okay.
If there aren't marketing and PR firms that already specialize in this, I suspect actually maybe there are. We just don't know about them. There should be. And what they should do is you come to them with a movie or any kind of media property that you're trying to generate interest in. And what they do is put that thing in front of people who they know will hate it and are activist in nature, mm-hmm. who start to generate a boycotting or censoring, calling for censorship kind of reaction to it.
Yeah.
And then that, of course, draws in all this curiosity. Oh, people are saying, well, I shouldn't look at this thing. I wonder what it is.
So you're saying send out screeners of the exorcism film you're talking about to church groups?
Yeah, to whoever's the most conservative and censorious person who would hate it. Or you could do it the other way around. Really, you could be, using something that would be offensive to any group. And almost anything might be offensive to somebody, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can think of several cases. I'm not going to mention any of their names because they don't deserve any more publicity. But there are several individuals who continue to seek out that notoriety for their creations, to create things purely to just sicken and piss people off. And that's the whole appeal. Like
are you thinking about a film about a mini segmented creature?
Yeah, that's one that comes to mind. Like I think that's a clear case of a guy who there's nothing at the heart of anything. There's nothing artistically mm-hmm. pure. There's nothing creative. There's nothing even fun. Nothing fun or even all that shocking per se. In a grander scheme, there's certainly more shocking pieces of cinema out there that have been created by actual artists. Mm-hmm. But it's just the storm that they're able to raise up around those creations and then make it like a part of our culture.
Yeah. Just empty, cynical bids for attention.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so I think the takeaway from this is that there does seem to be almost no surer way to draw attention to something than to try to prevent people from seeing it.
Almost like any attempt to manipulate the attention that we give to something, be it negative or positive. Like it's so easy. Like we think that it's going to be easy to economically manipulate something or even through censorship, manipulate the scenario, manipulate the way we interact with something. But it's just such a complicated affair. It's just we're gonna overflow the tub either way.
I think people do just have a sort of contrarian nature where we want to try to upset the narrative of the institutional authority.
Uh-huh.
I think about this with – so the Streisand effect definitely occurs with brands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll have an article or a meme or something like that that makes Coca-Cola or Pepsi or McDonald's or something look bad, and they'll try to shut it down, you know, no more uh-huh. of this. And that just doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just draws more attention to it. And it especially happens when you see these, you know, these like social media crowdsourcing message campaigns. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't remember what any of these hashtags are, but you know what I'm talking about. It'll be like hashtag Coke feelings. and Coca-Cola is trying to get you to do free advertising for them on your social media page. But of course, people respond to it with stuff, you know, diabetes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I can just tell any time a brand tries to shut down those sort of mischievous responses to their campaign, they're just going to make people want to do it more.
Yeah, indeed. You see that almost on a weekly basis these days.
Yeah.
All right. So there you have it. We went from cobras and rats and pigs to the horrors of scalp hunting and then back into the world of censorship. So hopefully we gave you a lot to consider in terms of the cobra effect here.
I think this makes me want to hear what your thoughts are, you out there, the listener, what your thoughts are about the nature of incentives.
Mm-hmm.
How do you actually guide people's behavior in a reliable way that doesn't produce these unintended and perverse consequences?
Yeah, I mean, really, we can hear from just about anybody on this. Are you a pet owner? Are you a parent? Are you a boss? Are you at all involved in or at least a close follower of politics?
Are you a government policymaker?
Yeah. Yeah. What happens when you start trying to push an issue with a, you know, stick with some money stuck on the end of it to get the results you need?
Yeah.
Let us know.
I'm sure some carrots work better than others.
Yeah. Yeah. There are so many different types of carrots, so many different types of sticks. Sometimes you just end up with no carrots or a horse that likes to be poked with a stick? I don't know.
Wait, what? How did we get there? Okay, sorry.
All right. So, hey, you wanna get in touch with us? You want to share your thoughts on this topic or others? First of all, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. Newly redesigned. It's looking great. Easy to interact with. You'll find that, again, at stufftoblowyourmind.com, along with various links out to our social media accounts, such as Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. We are Blow the Mind on most of those.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any others, or to give us a suggestion for a topic we should cover in the future, you can email us directly at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.